This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to the Luis Leal 100th Year's Birthday Celebration Conference. I am Maria Herrera Sobek, Associate Vice Chancellor for Diversity, Equity, and Academic Policy, and Professor of Chicana and Chicano Studies. I am also the Chair of the Organizing Committee of this two-day event, the other members being Professor Mario Garcia and Professor Francisco Lomeli. We are here to mark an important milestone in one of our most distinguished and beloved scholars, Professor Luis Leal, Don Luis, as we affectionately call him, his 100th birthday celebration. There are not very many people who live to this marvelous age, but as one of my colleagues commented last night, it is not that he has lived this long, it is the way he has lived these 100 years. In today's program, we will have two panels composed of distinguished scholars who are longtime friends of Don Luis as well as former students. The first panel will be in English and the second one in Spanish, with summaries given in English. Tomorrow, we will also have a series of events. So please check your programs for tomorrow's events. I would like to extend an invitation to all of you to attend the activities tomorrow, which includes a premiere documentary on Don Luis Leal. I would like to thank Chancellor Henry T. Yang and Vice Chancellor Jean Lucas for their steadfast support. I want to thank the staff who has worked tirelessly to make this program possible, in particular, Gretchen Falbo and Melanie Hoven. Our chancellor will now welcome you to our UCSB campus, Chancellor Henry T. Yang.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for joining us for this very special conference in honor of Professor Luis Leal. On the occasion of his 100th birthday, let's just acknowledge Don Luis. Let's give him a round of applause. Professor Leal is a treasure of our community, our local community, and our world community. With respect and affection, we all call him Don Luis. And I also learned that Don Luis, that D is a capital D. I also want to say thank you to our colleagues who have helped organize this very special event. Maria just mentioned herself and Mario Garcia and Francisco Lomani, our committee members, but I did not hear any applause. Yeah. And I also want to say thank you to our sponsors, including the Mexican Consulate of Oxnard, as well as many offices and departments across our entire campus, reflecting the cross-disciplinary impact of Don Luis. I also want to note that the celebration will continue till next month. It started officially, actually not today, last Friday, right? And our campus will host the 10th Colloquium on Mexican Literature in honor of Professor Leal. Professor Sarah Put Herrera told me, she said, the title of the colloquium will be 100 Years of Loyalty. Don Luis has had such an amazing life and amazing career, a lifetime of legacy, and his career is just legendary. Today's conference will provide you with just a glimpse of the incredible breadth and the depth of his contributions to literature, to culture, to education, and to even humanity. I still vividly remember 10 years ago when he was awarded a tremendously prestigious National Humanities Medal at the White House. At the time, I called him our national treasure. And we also remember that when he was honored with Mexican Order of Aztec Eagle. This is the highest honor granted to foreign citizens by the Mexican government. So we can also call him a national treasure of Mexico. He is a prolific and active scholar, 45 books. If you go 1.5 inch a book, that's 6 feet taller than Don Luis's own height, and plus 400 scholarly articles. I remember last year on September the Friday, we celebrate his birthday, 99th birthday, and Don Luis said, well, I'm writing a book, so next year. So this year, when I went to the lunch, and here is the book. A Luis Liao reader, edited and with an introduction by Ian Stavins. And Ian Stavins put it in the book that, let me quote, Liao is an exemplar of the term Hispanista. So I just want, I don't know what to say. His intellect, his humanity have won the highest respect, not only of scholars in his own field, but also of people from all disciplines and all walks of life, including my discipline as an engineer. He's known not only for his achievements, but also for his kindness, you would agree, generosity, humility, and sense of humor. I remember one time Maria thought he was tired. I said, let's call it off. The night is too long. He said, no, you are the one who's tired. And Don Luis has taught us so much, taught me so much. As a new chancellor, I sought out his wisdom. I remember in 1994, Dylan and I picked up one Saturday. We called. We said, we want to come to your home for some advice. So we went up for 4 hours. Don Luis gave me an unforgettable lesson on Chicana and Chicano studies and its evolution on our campus. And I remember I had notes. And Gladys kept coming out of bringing us cookies, coffee, tea, fruits, and the hospitality, and just wonderful. So I feel very honored that I had a tremendous honor of writing the introduction for his beautiful book, Myths and Legends of Mexico. And that book, Don Luis finished while he was of the age of 94. And some of us may not live long enough to even read the book. And these timely stories of that book, of creation, of history, of tradition, not only touched the heart of every reader, but also reminded us of the deep love Don Luis and Gladys have shared. So, Don Luis, I want to tell you that Gladys is with us today for this celebration. And I love that book so much. I have sent hundreds of copies to people all over the country. It has become our traditional university gift for our distinguished visitors, because that's the pride of this country. I would say Don Luis' reputation is bigger than our university. And I guess I have lots of nice things to say about you, Don Luis. But I also want to say that we at Santa Barbara are honored and proud to have Don Luis as a wise elder of our campus community. Sabio Maestro. We will treasure Don Luis, and we'll take good care of you. And of course, you will inspire us. You will take good care of us. And thank you so much to all of our participants. And let's say happy birthday again to Don Luis.
Thank you. Thank you, Chancellor Yang. And I must say that the other member of our organizing committee was also Chancellor Yang. He really helped us with the organizing with all his experience doing these type of events. Now I would like to introduce our Dean of Humanities and Fine Arts, David Marshall, who will give you also a welcoming remarks.
Thank you. I'm very glad to be able to participate in this event today. And on behalf of the College of Letters and Science and the Division of Humanities and Fine Arts, I want to add my words of congratulation to Professor Leal. I was thinking about a concept from the 18th century today. I know you're only 100 up to this point, but I work in the field of the 18th century studies, and I was thinking about a concept from that time, from the Enlightenment, the Republic of Letters. People in the Enlightenment talked about the Republic of Letters, and it was a time when national boundaries and repressive governments were creating many obstacles and limitations, but intellectuals, scholars, men and women of letters really tried to rethink their role and their citizenship in a larger network that really transgressed and crossed national boundaries. And it really is what gave us the Enlightenment, and I think is still so important today. And when I think of Professor Leal, I can't think of anyone else who has earned his role so much as a citizen in the Republic of Letters. Someone who has had as his colleagues, either because he has known them personally or he has written about them, he has helped to create their reputations, some of the best writers and most important minds of the Republic of Letters from the past and from our present time. But for Don Luis, the Republic of Letters is not a pantheon. It's not an exclusive club. It really is a democracy. And more than anyone else, I think he's helped to redefine what the Republic of Letters meant in our day, where every kind of language, every kind of literature, every kind of culture played a part in creating that fabric of what literature and culture and literary studies really was about. I know in your wonderful memoir with Professor Garcia, you talk about your memories of the Mexican Revolution as a boy. And I think that for the Republic of Letters to be viable, it is always perpetually incorporating revolution as well. And much of what Professor Leal did, although he's a great sort of recognized establishment figure in some ways, I think bore some risk and was revolutionary in its own way as well. So it's something which is really crucial to what a great university is and a great public university. And we're very glad that you have shared that with us. You mentioned 100 years of loyalty. I was thinking Victor Fuentes gave me this latest copy of the journal that I've followed since its beginning, celebrating the 40th anniversary of 100 years of solitude. And I think that we can thank you for 100 years of community, and it's a community that has really been very important for us at UC Santa Barbara. So congratulations.
Thank you for those splendid remarks. I always enjoyed your presentations. They're so scholarly, but I learn a lot. Now I would like to present to you Professor Beth Schneider, Associate Dean of Social Sciences, who is representing Dean Melvin Oliver, who could not be here with us today. She will also be saying a few welcoming remarks.
Thank you, Maria. On behalf of the Dean of Social Sciences, Melvin Oliver, who sadly isn't here with us today, we want to welcome all of the guests to this conference and to this wonderful celebration of Professor Leal on the occasion of his 100th birthday. Professor Leal is an extraordinary scholar, colleague, and friend of UCSB who has made significant and unique contributions to the intellectual life of our campus for almost 30 years, or in fact, 30 years. With a career spanning five decades, Professor Leal has significantly contributed to the study and understanding of Mexico, Latin America, and Chicanos in the United States. As we already heard from the Chancellor, he has received many distinguished honors, including the National Humanities Medal and the Mexican Order of the Aztec Eagle. So indeed, in those ways, he has been recognized way beyond our local community to the wider national and international community. For the Division of Social Sciences, Professor Leal is important in many ways, two of which I wish to highlight today. Professor Leal has interacted with the UCSB students as a visiting professor in Chicana and Chicano studies, for which they have been exceedingly grateful. Each year, the campus grants the Louis Leal Social Sciences Undergraduate Award in honor of Professor Leal, recognizing the outstanding interdisciplinary achievement of one of our students who majors in social science. The winners have come from a range of disciplines and have demonstrated excellence in their work, a testament to Professor Leal and his unbelievable record of scholarship. Secondly, as an internationally recognized scholar of Chicana and Latino literature, the Department of Chicano and Chicano Studies has benefited tremendously from Professor Leal's participation, stability, and solidity on the campus. He has been a continuing presence in the program, a continuing colleague to the faculty in the program, assuring it a measure of gravitas through the decades, sometimes of contention and most often of tremendous growth. As an important part of the Division of Social Sciences, the Department of Chicana and Chicano Studies is now in its third year of offering the PhD in the field, the first program in the United States to offer such a degree. In addition to this noble experiment in graduate education, the department provides our division and our campus an important model of how interdisciplinary work is taught and an exemplary model of the ways linkages can be drawn between the university and the community through its undergraduate internship program and through its linkages to the Center for the Study of Chicano Studies. On behalf of the Dean of Social Sciences, we are exceedingly pleased to honor Professor Liao's work and contributions to the campus and to the field and to the nation. And of course, we wish you a very happy birthday year, since it's already in progress. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth, for those beautiful words. Thank you. And now we will proceed with the panels. Professor Mario Garcia will be the moderator of the first panel, and Professor Lomeli, the moderator of the second panel.
Okay. Buenas tardes. Good afternoon again for everyone on this very, very happy occasion. So we need to have a lot of smiles. We were a little too serious at lunch. So we have more smiles and so forth, just like Don Luis. And anyway, thank you all for coming again, and we will commence with our first panel. But before we do that, just a couple of notes. First of all, the Center for Chicano Studies has copies of some of the books by Professor Leal, by Don Luis, or about him. So those of you that would like to, during our break, to go just outside where the table is and look at those books, and some of you would like to purchase them, they're for sale there. And then we'll have, after the... You can bring them back and have Don Luis sign them, or after we finish today, he'll be available, of course, to sign books for all of you. So please make note of that. And I just want to make another little short acknowledgement of someone who and his wife who have come a long way and who are very important, because he represents the first graduate student that Don Luis had at the University of Illinois. So I'd like to introduce, for those of you that have not met him, and his wife, Hilda, Professor Merlin Forster, and his wife, Hilda, if you could just stand up a bit. Okay. We have our first panel, and I will introduce each one of them as they come up to give their papers. First, we will start with Professor Seymour Menton. Professor Menton has been studying Spanish-American fiction for over 50 years. His best-known book is El Cuento Hispanoamericano, originally published in 1964 with several updated editions, the latest one in 2003. He has also published books on the novel and or short story of Guatemala, Costa Rica, Cuba, Colombia, and Mexico. His last four books are Latin America's New Historical Novel, 1993, Historia Verdadera del Realismo Mágico, 1998, Caminata por la Narrativa Latinoamericana, in 2002, and Un Tercer Gringo Viejo, Relatos y Confesiones, in 2005. Professor Menton has taught at Dartmouth College, the University of Kansas, and the University of California, Irvine, where he was the founding chair of the department's Foreign Languages and Literatures in 1965. He has also taught at the Instituto Federal de Capacitación del Magisterio Rural in Guanajuato, the Universidad de San Carlos in Guatemala, and the Universidad de Costa Rica, and the Instituto Caro y Cuervo in Bogotá. He also wants me to say that he has also shared many delightful experiences with Don Luis, dating back to the 1945 World Series in Wrigley Field, Chicago, and I hope we'll hear a little bit more about that, Professor Seymour Menton.
Thank you very much, Mario. It's a pleasure to be here. Although I have not yet tied Luis Leal for longevity, I'm going to prove to you today that I'm rapidly catching up with him. Luis and I, as Mario said, first met in October 45, Wrigley Field, Chicago, during the last World Series celebrated in that stadium. 6 years later, 1951, Luis published his first book entitled Mexico, Civilizaciones y Culturas, thanks in part to Professor James Babcock, chairman of the Spanish department at the University of Chicago, where Luis was teaching. The explanation is that Babcock was moonlighting as the foreign language textbook advisor for Houghton Mifflin, and he recommended that they publish Luis's book. To indicate how closely our hero's life and mine have followed parallel paths, the very next year, 1952, Babcock moved to Dartmouth College, the same Dartmouth College where a young servidor was beginning his college teaching career. Inspired both by Luis's first book and my own student and teaching experiences in Mexico, 1948 and 49, I began to write my own first book, Saga de México, with encouragement from the same Jim Babcock. However, unfortunately, I was not born under the same stars as lucky Luis Leal. When Babcock submitted my manuscript to Houghton Mifflin's executive committee, they rejected it on the grounds that the historical literary selections all came from only one country and that this would severely limit the number of possible adoptions. Undaunted, I contacted other publishers, and finally, as another example of our parallel lives, the book was published in 1955 at Appleton Century Crofts, where the foreign language textbook advisor was not Jim Babcock, but Joe Barlow, a retired professor from New York University, where I had studied for the doctorate. Almost 40 years later, Maria Herrera Sobeck, who now holds the Luis Leal Chair of Chicano Studies at Santa Barbara, collaborated with me in publishing a second updated edition of Saga de México. The next episode cannot be explained by coincidence or by parallelism, but only by magic realism. In the summer of 1963, Luis's book and mine were chosen as the basic text for the courses on Mexican culture and Mexican literature taught by us in Guadalajara at the second level NDEA Institute for High School Spanish Teachers of Mexican Descent. I no longer recall which one of us taught Mexican culture and which Mexican literature, but I do remember that one of our most outstanding students was Tomas Rivera, who a decade later was to publish what is still considered one of the very best works of Chicano literature, Y No Se Lo Tragó La Tierra, and the earth did not swallow him up. Not only that, but Tomas was destined to surpass his two Guadalajara professors by later being appointed chancellor of the University of California's Riverside campus. I'm now faced with the problem of how to make the transition from this personal prologue to my scholarly paper, which Mario said I had to give. How do you like this one? Luis and I, in our parallel careers, have never stopped struggling against the excessive specialization that has weakened U.S. universities in our lifetime. Just as Luis and I, in our respective textbooks, strove to capture the totality of Mexican culture and history, Agustin Yáñez and Carlos Fuentes had the same goal in mind in their respective operatic overtures to Al Filo del Agua and La Región Más Transparente. Actually, Yáñez and Fuentes were only two of at least six outstanding Spanish-American authors and one American of Portuguese descent who between 1930 and 1967 introduced one of their novels or collections of short stories with a brief synthesis of their countries in the form of a musical prose poem. The other five are Miguel Ángel Asturias, Romulo Gallegos, Eduardo Mallea, Severo Sarduy, and John Dos Passos. Like the operatic overture, these prologues establish the work's tone, include many of its leitmotifs, and synthesize its national themes in a musical fashion. Because we are celebrating today the life of a Mexican hero, and because I've been warned to limit my remarks to 16 minutes, I'm going to concentrate on only one author, Carlos Fuentes, who on November 11th will be celebrating his 80th birthday. The change from the small-town setting of Al Filo del Agua, 1947, to the metropolis of La Región Más Transparente, 1958, reflects the change in the image of the Mexican nation in only one decade. In spite of the fact that power has been centralized in the capital from the time of the Aztec Empire to the present, Mexico's literary image between 1910 and Miguel Alemán's period of 1946 to 52 was that of a nation with a strong provincial and rural flavor, in which the national prototypes were the peasants and the inhabitants of the small towns. Carlos Fuentes was the first important Mexican author to capture the new image of a modern urban Mexico. In spite of its brevity, only 2.5 pages, the untitled overture of La Región Más Transparente is an impressive musical piece transcribed in italics that captures the total image of the nation. For Fuentes, as for his predecessors, José Vasconcelos, Octavio Paz, and others, the key to understanding Mexico is its mestizo population. For that reason, Fuentes named his narrator Isca Cienfuegos, whose indigenous first name and Spanish family name reflect the opposition as well as the fusion of the two races. Isca, in addition to evoking the name of a famous Aztec prince, bears a striking resemblance to the Spanish words yesca, meaning tinder, and ascua, meaning ember, which are obviously associated with the fuego of the family name. Fuentes then proceeds to re-emphasize Mexico's racial roots by attributing its violence to both the Guerra Florida of the Aztec past and the barroom brawls, La Riña de Cantina, of the present. Although Fuentes would later express a more benign view of Mexico's Spanish heritage, the angry young man of the 1950s has his protagonist strongly condemn Cortez without naming him. And quote, "Born dead, you burned your ships so that others could fabricate an epic tale from your putrid flesh." Although Isca uses the first person plural nosotros to indicate that the descendants of the Aztecs and the Spaniards have lived together on the central plateau for more than four centuries, he also recognizes that the two cultures have not yet totally blended. Quote, "We have never knelt down together, you and I, to receive the same wafer." With an allusion to Michelangelo's famous painting of the Creation in the Vatican, Isca wonders whether the new 100% Mexican mestizo will ever be born. Quote, Let's see if someday my fingers will touch yours. The musical structure of this overture is based primarily on a crescendo movement. It begins with three very brief, prosaic sentences. My name is Isca Cienfuegos. I was born in Mexico City. That's not important. Then the sentences gradually expand through the repetition of the words afrenta, dia, abajo, derrota, en faz, and culminates in the anaphoric repetition of the word ciudad, 35 times it's repeated, followed by the closing, slightly modified echo of the novel's title, En la región más transparente del aire. Like Eduardo Mallea's La Ciudad Junto al Río Inmóvil, Romulo Gallegos' Canaima, and John Dos Passos' USA, La Región Más Transparente has a coda in addition to an overture. However, in Fuentes' novel, the coda, or epilogue, is much longer than the overture or prologue, 16 pages as opposed to 2.5. The epilogue's length is due to a more explicit review of Mexico's total history and a brief synthesis of its geography. Nonetheless, the musicality of the former is retained by the use of enumeration, repetition, and anaphora. In the enumeration of 116 historical figures, Spanish names are intermixed with indigenous names with a light sprinkling of foreign names. Politicians, authors, artists, and even movie stars are enumerated in random order. For example, Nezahualcóyotl, Cantinflas, La Bastida, Maximiliano de Habsburgo. In contrast, the enumeration of these famous people is immediately followed by a series of 80 parallel phrases beginning with the words tú qué, you who, with an occasional variant, referring to all those poor anonymous people from different eras who also contributed to the creation of the patria. Quote, tú que danzaste estrangulado por las flautas, tú que pintaste el ángel solferino y esculpiste el dios espinoso, tú que volviste a caer labrado de plomo, caminaste con un fusil oxidado. The cumulative effect of these two pages is further emphasized towards the end with an enumeration of a poor Mexican's typical food and clothing. Tú que comes chicharrón, tamarindo y mamé magullado, sopes y frijoles refritos. Tú que te pones un overol azul y un sombrero de petate y chamarras de mezclilla. The series of phrases addressed to the poor people in the familiar form of tú is followed by 16 parallel phrases addressed to upper-class Mexicans in the polite form of ustedes. The relatively small number of these latter phrases reflects the concentration of wealth and power in the oligarchy. Ustedes que viajan y van y vienen y poseen un nombre y un destino claro. Ustedes que construyen carreteras y altos hornos y sociedades anónimas y comparten su consejo de administración con Mister Aquí te invierto. Shortly thereafter, the narrator hears the voices of the poor imploring him not to abandon them, which provides the author with the opportunity to trace the total history of Mexico from the indigenous past to the 1950s by mentioning specific historical figures and events, and by alluding to others who only Lucas Macias, Luis Leal, and a handful of other Mexicanists would recognize, like El Gallero, Santa Ana. After enumerating many of the protagonists of the Mexican Revolution, Fuentes changes gears and draws a geographical caricature of Mexico as a human body. From the Puerto Isabel armpit, that's Baja California, to the toes of Cape Catoche, extreme northeastern tip of Yucatan, from the hip of Cape Corrientes, It's on Jalisco's Pacific coast, to the Nipple on the Panuco River, state of Veracruz, from the navel of Mexico City to the Tarahumara ribcage. To close the novel, the narrator indulges in another series of enumerations, this time of the streets and neighborhoods of Mexico City, that ends with the phrase, "and its 4 million people," 20 now, which serves as a transition to a review of the fictional characters who play important roles between the prologue and the epilogue, or between the overture and the extended coda. In order to stay within my allotted 16 minutes, I'd like to close with my own epilogue, which, like the prologue, is also set in Chicago. I am truly indebted to Luis for having inspired me to write this study about the series of national operatic overtures. Exactly 1 month and 10 days after the last game of the 1945 World Series, Luis invited me to celebrate the Dia de la Revolución, November the 20th, by accompanying him to see and hear my very first opera, Rigoletto. Luis said, "Forget about baseball, get cultured, come with me to the opera." All right, now, how did I get to Chicago, and how did I actually meet Luis Wrigley Field? One page. How many minutes do I have left? Two? On my 18th birthday in March of 1945, before reporting to the draft board, I read in the New York Times a fascinating article about one of the great heroes of the war in the Pacific, who was soon to be discharged in Chicago. Since at that time I was a Spanish major at City College of New York, what particularly attracted my attention was the man was a Mexican who had been drafted in 1942 at the age of 35. I was so excited by the article that when I got to the draft board that morning, I pleaded with them to overlook my nearsightedness and to send me to Chicago or as close as possible so that I could meet that outstanding Mexican hero, Luis Leal. They were so surprised by my unusual request that they immediately approved it. And 3 months later, in June, I found myself at the Great Lakes training base, only 46 miles north of Chicago. Believe it or not, I met Luis in October of that same year. Since I had been a big baseball fan since 1934, I was thrilled by the Cubs winning the National League pennant. On the day of Game 5 in the World Series against the Detroit Tigers, I hitchhiked to Chicago, arrived at Wrigley Field 1 hour before game time, entered free of charge thanks to my Seaman First Class uniform, boldly raced to the box seats, and leaned over the railing behind the Cubs' dugout when I spied their all-star third baseman, smiling Stan Hack. I called to him and asked if he'd be willing to have his picture taken with me at his side. The moment he accepted, I whirled around in search of a photographer. I noticed a tall, thin, weather-beaten soldier whose smile was very similar to that of Stan Hack's. When I asked him if he would please take our picture, he replied in his best Chicago accent, "Sure." And that's how my friendship of 62 years with Luis Leal began. Now, in order to dispel any doubts that you may have about the veracity of this story, here's the picture that Luis snapped in Wrigley Field on October the 8th, 1945. Luis is not only a great scholar, author of many, many books, but a great photographer. Okay. That's it. 16 minutes.
Oh, what a story. What a story. And actually, I have to apologize to Professor Menon because I forgot to mention the title of his talk, which is actually Prologues and Epilogues, Luis Leal, Carlos Fuentes, and Un Servidor. Our next panelist, Professor Sandra Messenger-Sipes, is formerly chair of the Department of Spanish and Portuguese at the University of Maryland, College Park, from 2001 to 2006, joined the faculty there in 1994, after having been at SUNY Binghamton from 1976 to 1993. Before that, she taught at other institutions, including Duke University. Author of numerous studies on the theater of Latin America, she was selected to write the chapter on Latin American theater for the Cambridge History of Latin American Literature. Her chapter on Caribbean theater appears in A History of Literature in the Caribbean, the primary reference book in this area. She's also co-editor of the drama section for the Handbook of Latin American Studies. Inspired by her mentor, Don Luis Leal, who directed her dissertation at the University of Illinois, Sipes has also published on topics dealing with issues of gender and national identity in Mexican culture. She has published on such Mexican writers as Elena Garro, Rosario Castellanos, Emilio Carballido, José Emilio Pacheco, and Sabina Berman. Her book, La Malinche in Mexican Literature, From History to Myth, published in 1991, is considered one of the most important texts on that cultural figure. Her talk today is entitled Reading the Layered Universe of Tlatelolco with Don Luis Leal and José Emilio Pacheco. Professor Sipes.
I still get nervous giving papers in front of Don Luis and Merlin, my professors. And it was very difficult to think of all the many works that Don Luis has done, what aspect of his career that I could dwell on. And I took advantage of the moment. Tomorrow is October 2nd. In Mexico, it's related to what happened in Tlatelolco. And so that was the reason I chose to discuss such a serious topic, because it actually was a very serious, grim event, described variously for outsiders as Mexico's Kent State or its Tiananmen Square protests as a way to suggest resonance with other cultures. It is still unknowable in its full tragic sequence. A massacre whose accurate proportions are shrouded in official subterfuge. It is characterized by two archetypal themes in Mexican culture dating from the conquest, betrayal and violence. Immediately, it caused a major change in Mexican literature, as well as in Mexican political life. Don Luis, as early as 1979, was one of the first critics writing in English who addressed this theme. Quote, "In literature, we can now speak of authors writing before or after Tlatelolco," says Don Luis in his essay, concluding with these points. The most important consequences of Tlatelolco in literature is the deep impression it left in the minds of the intellectuals and creative writers. The literature of Tlatelolco revealed that the ideals of the revolution, so strongly defended by the party in power, had become empty. José Emilio Pacheco reflects in his poem, 1968-3, "Piensa en la tempestad para decirte que un lapso de historia ha terminado." Fin de cita. In the essay in the Denver Quarterly, simply but evocatively titled Tlatelolco, Tlatelolco, Don Luis offers a comprehensive review of the varied literary works, including narrative, essay, poetry, and drama that deal with the theme. In my discussion now, I shall focus not only on his ideas, but also develop further his arguments about the poetry of José Emilio Pacheco, who later became a colleague of Don Luis at the University of Illinois. As is his modus operandi, Don Luis approaches the theme of Tlatelolco literature by providing his readers with an historical context deeply rooted in his perceptive understanding of Mexican culture. As the distinguished and most renowned scholar of the literature of the Mexican Revolution, a category that is perhaps the most studied literary subset in Mexico, Don Luis reminds us that there are similarities between what happened in 1910 and in 1968. Was history repeating itself, asks Don Luis, since in 1910, the dictator Porfirio Díaz had spent millions of pesos to celebrate the centenary of Mexican independence, while the workers subsisted on corn and beans. Similarly, President Díaz Ordaz had spent billions of pesos building the Olympic City in order to host the Games of 1968, even though so many Mexican laborers were out of work or unable to find sufficient food. One of the complaints of the students who gathered at the Plaza de Tlatelolco relates to this incongruity. While Porfirio Díaz was deposed soon after the centenary celebrations, beginning a violent period in Mexican history, the revolution of 1910 was meant to bring a profound social change for Mexico. What Díaz Ordaz's handling of Tlatelolco demonstrated was that Mexico's ruling priistas, after all the years of supposed post-revolutionary advances, treated Mexicans with the same contempt and neglect that caused the revolution in 1910. Another key point made by Don Luis in the essay also reinforces one of his major themes regarding the prophetic spirit of writers and the power of literary imagery. As he notes, even before the historical events of 1968, some Mexican writers had the wisdom to foresee what was to happen, and he refers to Carlos Fuentes' La Región Más Transparente as being already one of the texts that shows the underlying causes of what became the Tlatelolco conflict. At this juncture in time, the fundamental book on Tlatelolco is Elena Poniatowska's collage, La Noche de Tlatelolco, from 71, translated with a preface by Octavio Paz as Massacre in Mexico. It has become synonymous with the events as the testimonial that mirrors the multivocal reaction in Mexico, with photos and firsthand reports that belie the government's official statement that there were few deaths. Today, one could not investigate the history of that confrontation without consulting this text, and Leal, in 1979, calls attention to its unique contributions. As Don Luis writes, cita, "It was not the intention of Poniatowska in this book to establish the causes of the massacre or to answer the question why. That task was reserved for Octavio Paz and Carlos Fuentes." End of quote. As we are aware, in Poniatowska's testimonial, speeches, government statements share space with eyewitness accounts, photographs, and creative reaction pieces written by key writers, including in its entirety the poem by Rosario Castellanos, Memorial de Tlatelolco, of the older generation, and fragments of a poem by José Emilio Pacheco, who at that time was just 29 years old. Y el olor de la sangre mojaba el aire. Y el olor de la sangre manchaba el aire. Regarding these two brief lines from Pacheco's larger poem, Poniatowska offers a note that they come from the Nahuatl text translated by Padre Garibay. In fact, Pacheco's poem, with its intertextual title, Lectura de los Cantares Mexicanos, Manuscrito de Tlatelolco, is a complex piece that should be read on a number of levels. Ostensibly, as the reference to Garibay puts forth, it is a commentary on the events that took place on August 13, 1521, when the Tlatelolco area was the location of the last siege of the Spanish conquistadores against the Mexica peoples, bringing an end to Aztec rule. the smell of blood, the lamentations, the references in the poem to La Guerra Florida y Dador de la Vida are Nahuatl poetic tropes and describe the massacre of thousands of Mexica on that fateful day. Yet, Pacheco also includes a subtitle in parentheses, Octubre 1968, boldly connecting the 1521 events with the 1968 massacre at the same site. I've suggested that the poem itself is a palimpsest of Mexican culture in the same way that the Plaza de las Tres Culturas is also an architectural palimpsest. As its name suggests, the plaza contains cultural evidence of Amerindian, colonial Spanish, and contemporary Mexican societies. Before the arrival of the Spaniards, Tlatelolco had once been an independent city-state, replete with temples and one of the most important markets of the region, only to be memorialized as the site of the failed resistance of the Mexica in their battles with the Spanish conquistadores. As Don Luis reminds us, over the Mexica ruins, the Spaniards built the first church and the first school. With the advent of the 19th century industrialization, it became the railroad center of the Republic. Today, Tlatelolco has become a suburb of sprawling Mexico City, famous for its enormous housing project and as the site of the Secretariat of Foreign Affairs and the Plaza de las Tres Culturas, unquote. I am sure its unique nature as a ruin and as a vital part of Mexico City is familiar to many of us. In addition, I would like to suggest that that Pacheco's poem, like the plaza, similarly incorporates the physical remains from texts that represent the conquest and colonial periods, and also his own experiences as a resident of contemporary Mexico. As Ronald Friss observes, there are three apparent versions here: the Nahuatl original, Padre Ángel María Garibay's translation, and Pacheco's reworking of the Spanish version. Pacheco's poem incorporates the remains of the past so they are not forgotten, and also reflects the distinctive nature of the plaza as a multicultural site, a ruin that somehow continues to develop. In his commentary on the significance of this poem, Don Luis, so well known for his expertise in Mexican narrative, offers illuminating insights about the poem itself. At the same time, he refers to the relationship between the poetry of Pacheco and his narrative, and I quote, in his book of poems, No Me Preguntes Cómo Pasa el Tiempo, published in 1969, we find three poems dealing with the theme of Tlatelolco, the most important being Lectura de los Cantares Mexicanos, in which Pacheco uses the same technique he had utilized in the novel Morirás Lejos, the juxtaposition of two actions separated in time, which repeat the theme of the assault and slaughter of innocent and defenseless people. He very skillfully makes use of an incident recorded in pre-Hispanic Mexico as a metaphor for a contemporary event occurring in the same place, but separated by centuries. Unquote. Don Luis helps us to understand the unity that exists in Pacheco's many-faceted creative production. He leads us to read the poem along with the Nahuatl texts. We might want to think of this poem as a parody, but in the strict etymological sense of the term, as a song sung along with a previously existing text. As Linda Hutchin cautions us in her lengthy exploration of the subject of parody, quote, there is nothing in parodia that necessitates the inclusion of a concept of ridicule, as there is, for instance, in the joke or burla of burlesque, unquote. I would like to suggest that what Pacheco has done by reinscribing the Nahuatl descriptions of a massacre and leading us to compare that disaster with the current tragedy is not to mock or make ludicrous these serious texts, but rather to scorn those who would ignore the 1968 tragedy or belittle its significance. Those Mexicans who tried to find out what really took place that afternoon on the 2nd of October, 1968, were unable to learn the truth about it in their newspapers and official government reports. As Rosario Castellanos laments in her poem, ¿Quiénes? Nadie. Al día siguiente, nadie. La plaza amaneció barrida. No hurgues en los archivos, pues nada consta en actas. Castellanos' words lead us back to Pacheco's use of archival material, the Nahuatl texts. It became apparent that the government officials had eliminated any documentation about the atrocities that the government forces had committed that afternoon. One had to reconstruct what happened by use of allegory and parody, by reading the record of the origins of the Mexican mestizo nation during the conquest period. Especially parodic as a parallel text, that is, are Pacheco's observations. Con perfidia fueron muertos, sin saberlo, murieron. These lines refer at once to the Mexica of 1521 and the Mexicans of 1968. Despite the apparent parallelism of events, for most of the poem, Pacheco uses only the third person singular and plural of the verbs. That is, until the seventh of the 10 stanzas. Then, by switching to verbs in the first person singular, the speaker of the poem inserts himself as participant of the events being described. Ah, yo nací en la Guerra Florida. Yo soy mexicano. Sufro. Mi corazón se llena de pena. I agree with Don Luis's reading of these lines and his reference to the importance of community that Pacheco invokes, y cito. The contemporary inhabitants of Mexico feel a strong kinship with their ancestors, and at the same time, the similarity of tragic events awakens in them a sense of common faith, unquote. This sense of commonality to which Don Luis perceptively alludes is an important characteristic of the poem. At a time when Mexicans were feeling alienated from their government, Pacheco attempts to bring together all those who mourn for the victims of tragedy whenever and wherever they occur. It is José Emilio Pacheco's gift to be able to find solidarity and humanity across the centuries, beyond ethnicity, class, and cultures. It has also been the great contribution of Don Luis to appreciate and direct his readers to those characteristics in the great Mexican Chicano-Chicana writers to whom he has dedicated his life's work. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And we go to our last panel presenter, Professor Manuel Martin Rodriguez, who is a professor of literature at the University of California, Merced. His publications include Life in Search of Readers, Reading in Chicano Literature, Rolando Hinojosa y su Cronicón Chicano, Una Novela de Lector, La Voz Urgente, Antología de Literatura Chicana en Español, as well as numerous articles and edited volumes and journals, including the PMLA, Modern Language Quarterly, the Bilingual Review, and many, many others. He is currently working on a book on Gaspar Pérez de Villagra, forthcoming from the Universidad de León Press, and his paper today is entitled Reading Gaspar Pérez de Villagra in the 17th Century. Professor Manuel Martín Rodríguez.
Thank you, Mario. It is a pleasure being back in UCSB. It always will be. But in particular on this occasion, it is an extreme pleasure to be here to honor Don Luis and to celebrate his life and his achievements, and also what he's taught all of us, certainly what he's taught me, and what I hope he will continue teaching me for quite a while. By design or coincidence, the organizers wisely put together this panel in the same manner that bullfights are arranged. So as the least experienced bullfighter, I can only claim to have known Don Luis for 20 years, which obviously for him is just nothing, but for me it's much more. And I will relate that first meeting not for what it may contain of humor, but for the lessons I learned over time from that encounter when he was 80 and I was 20-something, I can't even figure it out at this point. And Professor Francisco Lomelí took me to meet Don Luis and to have a cup of coffee. And as I sat there, they spent a good 20 minutes discussing the predicament of a little bird with a piece of chewing gum stuck in a leg. And so they proceeded to consider the situation from all conceivable angle. And I began to suspect that this had less to do with the phenomenology of sparrows than with testing me to see what I would do. So in the best composure I could achieve, I did nothing. So I sat there stoically and waited to see what exactly that was all about. Now, down the road, I realized two things from that anecdote. One is that in addition to teaching us through his books, Don Luis, like Sor Juana before him, had realized that you can learn from life as much as you can learn from books. And he was certainly not only learning, but teaching. I didn't know at the time, because again, if I'm now the least experienced bullfighter, I was not even a banderillero back then. And the other lesson is that the devil is indeed in the details. And sometimes we really look for the big picture, and that's perfectly fine for what we do, but sometimes we overlook the details. So I hope you would not be bored, because I have decided to focus on very specific details for this presentation as my personal homenaje a Don Luis and his manner of allowing me to see the importance of details and that unforgettable afternoon with the bird and the cup of coffee. So this is about Gaspar de Villagra and certainly about Don Luis. In 1973, in the inaugural issue of the Revista Chicano Riqueña, Luis Leal advocated for approaching the study of Chicano-Chicana literature through a historical lens that would look beyond the immediate context of the Chicano movement all the way back to the colonial days of the U.S. Southwest. Though not immediately apparent at the time, Leal's challenge became, in effect, the seed for the recovery projects that have helped rediscover numerous forgotten or unknown texts of the Chicano past, and in so doing, have also transformed our knowledge of Mexican-American literary history. In that essay, among many other precursors of Chicano letters, Leal mentioned the soldier poet Gaspar de Villagra, whose epic poem Historia de la Nueva México was printed in 1610 in Alcalá de Henares, Spain. Villagra's Historia is the only example of the classical epic poem in all of Chicano literature, and it has the additional distinction of being the first printed book about New Mexico and one of the oldest historical accounts of any present-day U.S. territories. While Villagra is yet to achieve the critical recognition that other forerunners of Chicano literature now enjoy, most notably Maria Amparo Ruiz de Borton, and by the way, particularly for the young in the audience, the Don in the Squadron of the Don is not Don Luis, although he's close to that period. It is evident nonetheless that more and more critics and readers have been approaching his works in the last three decades. And what I mean his works is because in addition to the poem, he printed a few memoriales, and Professor Herrera Sobek has studied one of them, so that's where the plural comes from. In fact, as I have documented elsewhere, Villagra and his poem have been cited in well over 100 printed sources since Leal's 1973 essay. In addition, fragments of Villagra's poem appear in most of the anthologies used in schools and colleges across the country. And the complete poem has been published in 4 different modern editions in 3 countries, which suggests an even greater popularity in store for this Homer of New Mexico, as Bancroft, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, called him. Remarkable as this recovery of Villagra is, I should hasten to point out that my research on the reception of the poem has also documented over 100 printed references prior to the 1970s. The existence of this older body of information on Villagra may be even more significant, since modern critics have acknowledged no more than a handful of those earlier authors, most notably Bancroft, Marcelino Menéndez y Pelayo, and Alfonso Méndez Plancarte. Perhaps assuming there were no others to mention, I don't know. But to give but a simple example of how knowledge of those earlier printed references may alter the widespread perception of Villagra as a forgotten minor author, suffice it to say that the poem was cited 9 times during the first half of the 19th century, 4 times in French books, and once each in books published in Mexico, Spain, England, Brazil, and Argentina. The international scope of these references indicates a significant achievement for a 200-year-old epic poem that at the time had never been reprinted. The new picture that emerges from the reconstructed reception of Villagra's poem thus problematizes the routine assumption that the author and his work were all but ignored until recently. However, it does not alter in any significant way the reputation in terms of literary merit, as most sources agree that our author was a better historian than a poet, and they consider the poem to be of little artistic value. That may be the reason why neither Lope de Vega in his Laurel de Apolo nor Cervantes in his Viaje del Parnaso bothered to mention Villagra among the contemporary writers that they celebrated. But we might ask, what did other readers think? Are there ways to reconstruct the poem's reception beyond the printed opinions of scholars, writers, critics, and authors? One of the most significant sources of information to accomplish that task is found in marginalia and other handwritten notes in the surviving copies of the 1610 edition, which incidentally are more than were previously acknowledged as well. Their study is quite revealing in this respect, and I will present more detailed data in my forthcoming book that Professor Garcia mentioned. But in this paper, due to space constraints, I will limit my analysis to only one of those copies. What makes this copy particularly suitable is the fact that one of its owners wrote copious commentaries as he read. As I will discuss below, those comments were probably written in the late 17th century, and therefore they give us one of the oldest and most detailed responses to the poem that we now possess. The copy bears the name of several owners. One is partially obscured by an ink stain, but the words Gómez Villa remain visible. The other two can be read without difficulty, and they correspond to Don Santiago Vivanco and to El Licenciado Diego López de la Serna, quite likely the author of most comments, if the similarities in penmanship can be trusted. Establishing the identity of these 3 individuals is difficult, but some possibilities may be entertained as to who they might have been, except in the case of Gómez Villa, whose 2 very common last names complicate this task. As for the other 2, we find that Diego López de la Serna identified as officer of the Cofradía de Nuestra Señora de la Asunción in 1652 in Calzada de Calatrava in the La Mancha region of Spain. Might this have been the same licenciado who owned a copy of Villagra's Historia? It is certainly not far-fetched to imagine him a licenciado, given his position as a prioste of the said Cofradía. There is also an intriguing possibility that the other owner might have been Santiago de Vivanco Sáenz de Aguayo, a second-generation Chilean born around the end of the 17th century or the beginning of the 18th. In favor of this hypothesis, one could argue that the name Villagra would have easily caught the attention of Chilean readers, of that period, given the role that Francisco de Villagra, a relative of Gaspar, played in the conquest of Chile. What little we know about the lives of these two individuals also suggests that López de la Serna could have owned this particular copy in the mid to late 17th century, and then Santiago de Vivanco could have acquired it later in the 18th century. In any case, what matters more than the actual identity of the owners are the comments that one of them, again, probably López de la Serna, wrote on the book. These comments, as mentioned, are not isolated annotations of the kind found in many of the other copies, but rather they reveal a continuous engagement with the text throughout the more than 300 folios, that is, over 600 pages, that compose the printed volume. In contrast with the typical passing remarks of critics and bibliophiles, whoever annotated this particular copy must have felt that the poem spoke directly to him. In fact, the reader's involvement with the Historia is so intense that he even rewrites several lines of the poem to achieve a fuller artistic or meaningful effect. The first instance of such a rewriting occurs on folio 19, recto, where the reader crosses out the adjective vivos and replaces it with fuertes to make the line read tan esforzados, fuertes y alentados. From that point on, he seems to gain steam, and partial emendations occur every few folios, in fact, in most folios. And the reader even dares to alter complete lines, as in folio 38, recto, in which the line gota coral, furioso derramado, is crossed out and substituted by fuego infernal de las furias vertido, not a single word in common. Clearly, the commentator noticed some limitations in Villagra's artistry, but rather than dismissing the poem as prosaico and rastrero, as Menéndez Pelayo would do later, he did his best to retouch it as needed to enhance his personal enjoyment. At other times, however, the reader acknowledges the literary merits of the poem, in particular in the many comparisons used by Villagra, which the commentator faithfully highlights in the margins. The reader's deep involvement with the text is also felt at the thematic level, in which numerous commentaries suggest a remarkable ideological and personal affinity with the poet. Already in folio 6, recto, the reader celebrates the opening life of the second canto, which read, cuando la majestad de Dios aparta del católico bando algún rebaño, señal es evidente y nadie ignora que aquello lo permite su justicia por ser aquel camino el menos malo. To which the reader replies with the marginal note, gran sentencia. Like Villagra, the reader must have been deeply religious, which would be logical if he were indeed López de la Serna, and whenever the poet indulges in religious meditation, the reader responds in earnest, as in the opening lines of Canto Settimo on the Vanitas Vanitatis Topos, which elicit the following comment from the reader, Esperanza de esta vida futiles y vanas. The reader and the poet also seem to share the counter-reformist zeal against the Jews and the conversos, and on folio 31, when the poet begins a long diatribe against them with the following interpellation to King Philip III, and I quote, solo una terrible falta hallo, cristianísimo rey, en vuestras Indias, y es que están muy pobladas y ocupadas de gente vil, manchada y sospechosa. After urging the king to enforce the laws prohibiting Jews and conversos from traveling to America, the poet ends with the story of a certain Josefo, who curses the Inquisition for spoiling his scheme to convert all Christians to Judaism. To the predictable indignation of the poet, the reader adds in the margins, dicho audaz de un judío, o por mejor decir locura horrenda, que no eran tan viles e infames los cristianos que a todos los había de vencer y convertir a su ley. The colonial politics of the text are also endorsed by its commentator at every conceivable occasion. Whenever Villagra discusses the many sacrifices endured by Oñate's army, the reader is quick to express his admiration for the men of arms. In the 11th canto, the reader writes across the page, gravísimos trabajos que fueron padeciendo sin alivio alguno. And on folio 174, when Villagra recounts the day-to-day misery of serving the king as a soldier, the reader insists on the thought, writing, pobres conquistadores, con menos se alcanza el cielo. If Villagra ever envisioned an ideal reader for his poem, the commentator of this copy must be very close to that image. And I don't think it was him, actually, if you're entertaining the thought, who commented his own poem. Needless to say, the reader also sides with Villagra whenever the poet criticizes the colonial bureaucracy. Upon reading about the delays to which Oñate's expedition was subjected by the authorities, The commentator writes with mounting indignation, "Estos visitadores parecían ciegos de entendimiento. Santo Dios, que haya hombres que manden tales disparates y se tengan por letrados y entendidos." To finally wonder, "Jesús, una y mil veces, ¿qué género de hombres son estos?" The reader's almost blind acceptance of the authorial point of view even extends to those episodes in which the soldier's behavior might be easily questioned. In folio 90, the soldiers that went to explore the Rio del Norte are instructed by the Sargento Mayor to lie about the harshness of the territory, to which the reader simply reacts by noting hombres de valor next to these lines. But perhaps the most interesting comments are those in which the reader indulges in a sort of social criticism, comparing the society depicted in the poem with his own. The 17th century preoccupation with the abuse of the title of Don, which obviously we don't have to worry about in this case, elicits some interesting commentaries from our reader. On folio 18, next to a line that mentioned Cristóbal de Oñate, without that treatment of respect, the reader writes, "Cristóbal de Oñate sin don, hoy todos lo son." The reader also expresses his reservations on the Castilian temperament upon reading about charges against Oñate, and he writes, "Don Juan imputado de Aleve, plaga antigua de esta desdichada tierra." When Villagrá complains about the poor compensation received by officers and soldiers and about the cold treatment they receive when visiting the government's office, the reader, of course, sides with him once more, while adding some commentary of his own on his own society. "Por esto y otras cosas decía un discreto que palacio, palacios, eran palazo y palazos. Oh, pobres soldados, si por Dios no sufrís las milicias." Queja universal, etc. Likewise, when Villagrá exposes the greed of the colonial authorities, denouncing cómo se hace un puro hombre Dios del suelo, the reader adds, "Esta divinidad va a más cada día, no sé a dónde ha de ir a parar." While time limitations preclude me from analyzing these and similar commentaries in depth, I would like to mention briefly another set of annotations that reveal the reader's curiosity about the new territories and societies that the poet describes. And so the New Mexican landscape and fauna prompts many comments that I will skip for the sake of brevity. And likewise about the societies that they encounter. I'll mention just a couple because I think that they're quite open to a deeper analysis, which again I won't do here, particularly when he refers as the encounter with the Indios Pueblo, and he says, "Indios sabidos tratar son mansos y dóciles, and Indios se sujetan con facilidad." So his total acceptance of the colonial project is not surprising, but perhaps more intense than was the case with most other readers. Well, some of the reader's remarks I have transcribed might give the impression that he was somewhat naive, if not extremely so, particularly because of his straightforward endorsement of the politics and opinions of Gaspar de Villagrá. In truth, I must say that he was a cultured and well-read individual, as some of his other annotations demonstrate. When he reads Luis Tribaldos de Toledo's prefatory Canción Pindárica, which is printed at the beginning of the volume, the reader writes down, "No ajustó bien el poeta este título de estrofa ni antistrofa, porque la significación que les hallo en calepino y vocabulario es que estrofa significa astucia o engaño o cosas de juguete, y ninguna de estas especificaciones cuadra aquí." And he goes on to discuss other matters of literary analysis. A few pages later, and I will be concluding more or less with this, when Villagrá refers to the legend of Aslan, our reader writes the following on the margin. "Fray Martín de León, Dominico, en su historia Camino del Cielo, folio 98, dice fueron cuatro hermanos los que guiaron y trajeron a los mexicanos, Huitzilopochtli, Huitzilihuitl, Mexitzin, Tenochcatzin." The examples, once again, are too numerous to list here, but they leave no doubt about the reader's background and intellectual formation. They also serve as testimony of his meticulous method of reading, which includes contrasting the text at hand with previous sources he was familiar with and cross-referencing frequently within the text. In sum, this surviving copy of the 1610 original printing of the Historia is a remarkable document of how the poem was read within the first century of its publication. If at a later date scholars and critics began to doubt its merit, this particular reader found very little in the poem that he did not like, and when he did, he simply rewrote the lines as he thought best. Thanks to documents like this, we can begin to supplement the history of the printed reception of the poem with details on private readings. The resulting account, I believe, will help us meet the challenge raised in 1973 by Don Luis to better understand the significance of Gaspar de Villagra, in this case, for Hispanic readers in general and for Chicano literature in particular. Thank you very much.
I think we have maybe just a few minutes. I know we're going to have a break, but maybe if there's a couple of questions or comments from the panel, and then we'll have our break and then move on to the second panel, which will be a shorter panel since there's only two presenters. So are there some questions or comments from the panel for each other or from the audience that people would like to ask? Well, if not, we'll have our break. How about that? Don't forget that there are books outside that are available to you and for Don Luis to... Oh, I'm sorry.
I just didn't have a chance to say that in 1975, when Don Luis retired from the University of Illinois, I was privileged to speak then, and I heard him speak at Merlin's retirement, and now I'm hoping that in the future, a few years from now, he'll speak at my retirement, but I'm going to wait for a while.
Well, let's thank you very much. Let's thank all of the panelists up here, and we will have our second panel at a quarter to the hour. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.